You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas. And you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for April 4th, episode 3401.
What is your favorite day of the week?
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
Welcome back to the show, Mary.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Yeah, we missed out last month. Things got crazy. Before we do anything else, since I spoke to you last, Road to the Horse happened, and you did not have the opportunity to attend in person this year, but you watched the live stream, did you not?
Yes, I was not able to watch some of the later rounds, but I was able to get, you know, live updates, and I watched all of the first round. So I have a pretty good idea of what all went on.
So overall, how would you rate this year's Road to the Horse?
It was really, really good. I think the competition was really tough. I think some of the horses were really tough. This is the first year they went with the Pitchfork Ranch horses, which are similarly bred, but not entirely the same as the Sixes colt. So it was really interesting to see a new group of horses. I think Tick Maynard killed it. He did an incredible job. Not only, you know, you see years where competitors win because they did the most on their horse, but then you see years where competitors win because they just hands down had the best horsemanship. And I think this was definitely one of those years.
Interesting. Interesting. So at the beginning of the competition, when you watched the, did you get to watch any of the wild card? The wild card, for those not in the know, is the first day of competition. I'm going to use my air quotes. They have usually four different competitors come in, and they basically do a mini Road to the Horse. And the winner of that gets to go on the next day and do the proper competition with everybody else. So did you get to watch any of the wild card?
I didn't. I was getting a few updates from friends, and it sounded amazing. I knew C.D. Wilcox was going to do a great job. He's a student of Mike Majors, and sounds like he just did an incredible job. I think for that one, they worked with fillies.
They
while
did,
for the
yes.
main competition, they had geldings. Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of people ask about that, and it's for the sake of consistency, because, hello, mares are mares, even when they're babies. And that way you don't have to deal with the hormone fluctuations, which might be conceived as an unfair advantage or a disadvantage to one competitor to the other. And that's why they do it that way. It was interesting. I watched the they call them the remudas, the groups of horses that are brought for each of the two competitions, the wild card group and then the regular competition group. Not a quarter horse expert in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, I would say I'm probably a quarter horse clueless when it comes to quarter horse bloodlines and such. But my impression was that the Pitchfork Ranch group of horses seemed to be more, I'm going to use the word refined, than the 4/6 horses. The 4/6 horses would come cruising out into that in their big, brawny, buxom beasts, to use some alliteration. And it was very obvious that those were made to be working horses. Whereas the Pitchfork group came in, I just had the impression that they maybe had some more blood in them. I don't know anything about their bloodlines, but they just struck me as a little bit more refined horses. to look at?
Yeah, I was glancing at the paperwork on the Pitchfork horses, and it seems like definitely there's a lot more modern breeding and cow horse cutting breeding bred into them. So yeah, you're definitely going to start to see kind of smaller bone refinement, maybe a little bit more, sensitivity and that kind of stuff that you see with that cow breeding. The sixes horses do have some of that, but you're going to find more of the old school ranch horse and, you know, bigger, hardier. So yeah, it is really interesting to see the difference.
Yeah. And why is it that ranch horses are all chestnuts? What the, you know?
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Year after year, the sixes horses would come in, and year after year, it would be seven chestnuts, a roan, and a palomino every year.
Yeah, you wouldn't see as much variety. I think because, like, they just need to be good for using. And if you happen to get one with some color, then yeah, whoopity do. But
I need to ask a geneticist if chestnut is dominant, because I don't know. I don't know enough about genetics.
Sorry. What did you say? I missed that question.
I said I'm going to have to ask a geneticist about why we get so daggone many chestnuts.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay, coming up, geneticist. We're gonna delve into colors. Colors of quarter horses. We're gonna do it.
Yeah, I'm really bad about, you know, I've got friends who are like, oh yeah, if this color breeds this color, you're going to get this color. I have no idea. No. I'm just like, okay.
No, there's so many variations I know there's three base color coats and everything goes out from there, but I don't even remember which of those takes dominance over which and which is recessive and stuff. So again, next guest coming up, color geneticist, we're going to go there. So anyhow, the competition overall was really, really good. I saw a lot of really enthusiastic comments from our auditors group, the Horse Radio Network auditors group. If you're not an auditor yet, you need to go to Horse Radio Network, find Horses in the Morning on the shows page. It's easy to do. And on that homepage, there will be a link to go and become an auditor. Auditors pay a small amount of money that they choose every month through Patreon, and that helps to support Horse Radio Network show hosts like Mary. Dun, dun, dun. You're putting food on the table, people.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And the other thing that auditors do is they get to submit questions when we do our monthly training show here on Horses in the Morning. And we got some really good ones this time. But usually before we do our listener Q&A, we usually have some kind of a training tip inspired by some kind of type B fun that Mary's had recently. So what's the deal this time?
So this time we're going to talk about the importance of hauling your horse and how that's going to help you in the overall training of your horse. And this was inspired by actually a training horse that just went home today. He's a Gypsy Fjord cross. So he's like super cool little dude that I'm actually going to miss. I grew really attached to that guy. So I had him for 90 days. And, you know, when I got him, it's kind of dead of winter. There's not a lot of stuff going on. You know, the weather's not all that great to go out on trails and stuff like that. So I started out his training mostly at home on the ranch. And he was fine. He's like really relaxed and chill and nothing really phases him and putting them through the motion. And then I noticed as soon as it was nice enough and there were events on the calendar to start hauling him to, I had a completely different horse on my hands.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So I'm sure everyone has experienced that where you go to the horse show and your horse jumps off the trailer and is just screaming bloody murder and acting like he remembers nothing. And so the first half of his training was like, hey, can you, you know, do you remember how to go left and right? And, you know, can you neck rein and all of the fundamentals and that kind of stuff. But the second half of his training was really dedicated to let's go as many places as we can possibly go. And the good thing about hauling your horse is the act of hauling itself will do the training. Obviously, you have to keep your horse mindful and listening and all of that, but where the really good stuff happens, that, you know, just gets them ready for the world. It's just going to town. And so that's what I did with him. And, you know, when I haul a horse for the first time, it can be good. Like what I did with this guy is I brought him with my steady Eddie boy, Remy. And he just got, anytime I got a chance to throw him in a trailer, I did. And he just got to be a sidekick. And some weekends I hauled him and he didn't do any showing. He was just there. He just got to go on a trailer and stay in a strange stall and stand tied and maybe do a little groundwork or a 15-minute ride here and there. And then that's what he did for the weekend. And then sometimes I hauled him and he got to be the star and he got to enter the show. And I had a cowboy once tell me that you could put 30 days of training on one in a weekend just by hauling him out. And boy, if that isn't the truth.
That's true, because it really changes up the criteria. It tests what you've done so far, whether or not it's really sunken in. Oh yeah, that makes absolute sense. And it's really hard because in this day and age, shows for the most part charge extra if you bring those horses along that are just coming along to gain experience. They charge you for that horse to show up. So it's a little harder than it used to be, especially if you're someone who is a DIYer. You don't have a coach, a trainer, a hauler, and things like, or even worse, if you don't have your own trailer, you have to pay to haul somewhere. That is a really hard process to go through because it costs you dollars, but it doesn't seem like you're getting anything back. You know, you don't have the opportunity to compete. But
yeah,
I absolutely agree with you. And 5 years ago, I wouldn't. I said, oh no, you just train them real good at home. They'll be fine when you get away. They scream a little bit and that's different. But I think there are a lot of horses that the process of going away, existing and not dying and coming home again needs to be practiced. Otherwise, they don't ever settle in. They go to 3 horse shows a year, and every time they go to a horse show, they go berserk on you, and it's a horrible experience for everyone. Well, that just reinforces the fact that it's a horrible experience if you don't go through that week in, week out, regular drive down the road, go somewhere for the day and come home.
Yes. And then it's like, I just paid $500 for my horse to make me look like an idiot all weekend.
There you go.
And almost take out the judge in our class. So yeah, those first trips out where you aren't doing a whole bunch with your horse, or maybe those first few shows where your horse didn't do as good as he was supposed to do, it feels like a waste. But really, you're putting deposits in that bank account for the future. And it pays off over time, you know, and it really, I've been hauling to about a show a month for the last 3 or 4 years. I've been, you know, really hitting the road with that show circuit and with my horse Remy. And one thing I realized about Remy, and Remy's easygoing guy, he was easy to train, easy to start. But I would say it took him like 2 years of hauling. Just that experience to where now I know that I can throw them in a trailer any given weekend, hop them right off the trailer, saddle them up, get on, go. And he is a consistent dude. He will give me a good performance every time. I don't have to worry about him being barn sour, buddy sour, you know, pacing around while he's tied to the trailer. And, you know, it is because I just spent hours and hours and hours hauling. And let's say there isn't any events around, or you're not ready to go to the show, you don't have the money. I had a friend who used to load horses up in the trailer in the morning and then haul down the road to the local hole in the wall breakfast joint, park the trailer and go eat breakfast, and then get back in the truck and go home. And, you know, so you can still find ways to Absolutely. Give your horse the experience without Absolutely. Breaking the bank.
Absolutely. And something as simple, if you're somebody who keeps your horses at home, you can develop a relationship with a local boarding and training stable that maybe has an arena that you can pay a tiny fee and just haul in, ride around the arena and haul home. You can go to a friend's house. I have literally put Nigel in a trailer and driven around the block. I have done that many times because he did have issues with hauling, with being away from home, all the baggage, he had it all. And I was started out with literally drive around the block. It was 4 minutes and we were home. And it eventually got to the point that we got on the interstate and drove to the next exit, got off the interstate, drove the back way home, done for the day. He didn't even have to get off the trailer and do anything at a venue. because we have to break it down into much, much smaller pieces. But again, that's one of those things that, okay, that's going to suck up my entire Saturday. That's a Saturday I didn't get to ride my horse and practice my left lead and all those things. And it's really hard to remind yourself that practicing your left lead all day long is not going to help if the horse loses his marbles when you get to the show. Left lead doesn't matter at that point.
The last thing on your mind. Yeah, you're just wanting to make sure that everyone stays alive. And there are those aspects of training that we so often gloss over until it becomes a big problem. And they're the kind of almost non-event things where you're not actively like, okay, we're training this maneuver. And, you know, those things can include staying in a stall if your horse is used to a pasture, or standing tied for more than 15 minutes at a time. And those kinds of things do need to be worked on, because even if you don't show and you don't plan on going down the road all the time, it's still a good habit for your horse to have, because maybe you wake up one morning and your horse is not feeling well and you've got to take him to the vet and he needs to be able to hop right on the trailer and go with no issues. Or maybe you have to evacuate because you're in an area that has wildfires. And so it's a useful skill to have, to be able to, you know, get your horse on the trailer and go. And you just never know. Sometimes life just happens and you've got to be prepared.
It's a life skill that all horses should know how to get on a horse trailer without putting themselves or their humans in danger, and ride in that horse trailer in a reasonable fashion. Because, you know, if you don't get hauled much, they're going to be a little excitable. But at least by practicing, because I always used to tell my students that one third of this is teaching the horse or desensitizing the horse. The other two thirds is having an understanding of what their behavior patterns are. When they're over threshold because it's a new place, their go-to behaviors are these, and I can be prepared to deal with those behaviors because we've practiced before. We did the fire drills, like you like to say. So even if, like you said, even if you're not going to be a competitive rider or even drive someplace with as a trail horse, it's a good skill to have. There are too many horses out there that end up in the going down the road to Mexico pipeline, and that's what they're missing. They don't have life skills.
Yeah, I had to send a horse home many years ago. He wasn't with me for training. The owner specifically just wanted to sell the horse. And so my job was going to be like, just tune the horse up and find a buyer. And the horse knew all sorts of really great skills under saddle. And he'd been at a roping trainer, and she thought, oh, you know, he could maybe get a lot of money as a rope horse. And so I wasn't getting the training fee. I was just getting the, hey, you are keeping him fed and riding him and showing him to buyers. And one of the skills that he lacked severely was tying. And I tied him up in my arena for 5 minutes, went to get my saddle, I came back out, and he kicked all the boards out in the corner of my arena. And I was like, oh no. And so I gave him a week of like, you know, hey, you could get over this. And he never did. He, you know, just paced back and forth, He could not stand tied. The other thing he couldn't handle, any paddock he was in, he would pace. In the week I had him, he'd already begun to lose weight because he just paced back and forth. And because I wasn't getting paid to actually train him and overcome these issues, I sent him home because I said, I cannot sell this horse in good conscience. Especially to a roper, they're not going to put up with a horse that doesn't stand tied. Those horses
spend a lot of time waiting. Yeah.
Yes. They need to be able to be okay with that. And you know, the horse didn't end up in a bad situation, but it's just one of those things. That horse could have been, you know, the best freaking rope horse in the land, but he lacked this essential skill that a buyer is going to look at and go, nope, you know, because then that's going to be their problem to deal with. And this is an older horse that had it deeply ingrained. So, you know, those are some things to think about with your horses, not only to make life better for you, but if you need to sell them, things like being able to get on a trailer, being able to stand tied, all of those things are extremely important and are going to the horse's life. If he ever, you know, goes two different owners.
That's right. And yeah, exactly. And a lot of times when you bring a new horse into your life, either because you bought one or you're training one, those gaps in their training are not immediately obvious. And you hear it a lot because you train people's horses. I bought this horse. He was sold to me as, insert words of choice. I got him home. 2 weeks later, I discovered, insert bad habit of choice. You didn't know about it till you got the horse home. Now, there's mm-hmm. it's a double-edged sword, because on one side, the seller ought to disclose those sorts of things, because that's only fair to the horse, because one guy's deal breaker is another guy's, I don't care. So he paces in the paddock. One potential buyer might say, oh, that's fine, I can work with that. Another potential buyer might say, forget it, deal breaker. So A, disclosure, but B, it's before you let that horse move on, maybe you should try to deal with that a little bit, or at least disclose it to the next person so they don't, you know, end up with the problem.
Yeah, you're going to be setting your horse up for success. The more life skills that he can have, because him not being able to do a flying lead change is far less important than him not being able to stand tight and you know, all of those just kind of basic life skills. And because it's we want to make sure that they're always set up for success when they go down to the road to a new place.
Absolutely. And speaking of being set up for success, dun, 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 we have listener questions today. And we are going to get to our listener questions right after we hear from one of our sponsors.
Recharge your training program with Equestrian Plus. Equestrian Plus brings together top riders, trainers, and professionals onto one video platform. Watch over 5,000 how-to training videos, clinic and event footage, exclusive training sessions, and more, featuring top experts including 5-time dressage Olympian Stefan Peters, 5-time Olympic show jumper Ann Krasinski, Olympic eventer and silver medalist William Fox Pitt, and more. Join Equestrian Plus now and use promo code HRN15 for 15% off your first month. Visit EquestrianPlusPLUS.com to subscribe.
What is our first question from our listeners today?
Let's go with this one from Kelly, and she wants to know when do you know when it's time to move on? So she has a 7-year-old ex-Amish Dutch harness horse, amazingly gifted with dressage movement, which I've seen that, too flippin' smart, and was most likely only used to race the boys off to basketball practice in the buggy. He is sweet, lovely horse, willing to please, but holy catfish, he's so sensitive. Finally figured out how to use treats without him mugging me, so I might finally be on the right track, but if it keeps raining here, I'll never find out. Can you tell I'm frustrated? Okay, so I don't know specifically what problems you're having, and I assume that the question you're asking is when it's time to maybe sell this horse and get another horse. That's what I'm going to assume. And the answer all comes down to it depends. If you were to ask 20-year-old me when it's time to give up on a horse or move on and make different choices, it's going to be wildly different than 40-year-old me, because what I'm willing to, the risks I'm willing to take are completely different than they were when I was young, dumb, and stupid. And so when I ask myself when it's time to move on, anytime you work with a horse, no matter how broke they are, you are putting yourself at risk, your health and safety at some form of risk. But it's usually a calculated risk. And you have this idea in your head of what you're willing to put up with, what you're willing to risk. And when that kind of, when I'm working with a horse and I start to feel like this is too much risk for me, I have no problem moving on and selling that horse, finding a different situation for that horse, or maybe just retiring that horse and they can be a pasture pup, and then thinking about another horse to work with instead. I don't have a problem with that because, number one, no matter how much I love a horse and think a horse has potential and want the horse to succeed, number one is my own health and safety. You get one life and that's it. And so you've gotta treat it for how precious it is. And so that's the first thing that comes into play when I'm thinking about, is this horse well suited for me? Is this going to work out? I want to make sure I'm going to be reasonably safe. Like I said, anything we do with horses is a risk. So you have to decide for yourself, how much risk am I willing to take? Because you're taking your life in your own hands every time you get on a horse. So that's number one. The next thing I'm going to look at when I'm working with a horse is how much I enjoy it. Because why are we doing this if not for fulfillment and to enjoy something in our lives? We want to have fun with it, and we want to be happy. We want it to fulfill us. For some people, and myself included, that fulfillment comes with working with a challenging horse and overcoming all the problems that horse throws at me. But again, there's going to be a line, and it's different for every person, and it's different for every person at different stages of their life. There's going to be a stage in my life where the only horse I want to get on is the oldest, steady Eddie horse that has nothing to prove and wants to just pack me around on a trail. And that, you know, that's coming sooner rather than later. So when you feel like I don't enjoy this anymore, and this is actually causing me more pain and suffering, you have permission to figure out a different situation. Again, whether it's to retire that particular horse and just let him live in your pasture, or to rehome, or to sell, you know, it's okay to do that. So those are two of the factors that come into play when I'm going to decide, you know, what I want to try, when it's time to give up. Can every horse be trained? Absolutely. Any horse on the planet can be trained. But, you know, for some horses, you might be looking at years and years of very hard work, very time-consuming work, very expensive work. And you have to look at yourself and decide, you know, am I enough rider for this horse? Because we don't always ask that question. We tend to ask the question, you know, is this too much? We don't really look at ourselves as riders all the time. And I'm willing to admit there are some horses where I'm not enough rider for them. I should not be on this horse. And that's okay. It's realistic. So, you know, you want to, again, evaluate yourself. Is this too much horse for me? Can I handle this horse? Is this making me happy? Is this safe? Again, especially like if you've got a family and kids and a full-time job, those are things that are, you know, you've got to think about when you're working with these horses every day. So I can't give you a straight answer on this particular horse. Just know that the journey for every horse to get to what, you know, to where they're what I would call a broke horse, it's years for even the easiest horse. So take that into consideration when you're working with a horse. And if you just feel like you're, you know, going around and around in circles, you're not getting anywhere, you're not enjoying it, you don't feel safe, then it might be time to think about moving on.
Yeah. And that's a toughie. I freely admit that I am the worst at selling a horse. A lot of trainers, a lot of people who own barns, a significant part of your income is selling horses. Either you buy them and sell them, or you sell them for clients, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I sucked. Terrible horse seller. But yeah, exactly. The ones that I did sell, and sometimes I sold some of the nicest horses I ever had, because I recognized, for me, that horse had the real potential to be something way beyond my skill set. That horse has the potential to do amazing things in insert discipline of choice. And I recognize that I wasn't going to be able to ever ride at that level, but I can bring them up to the level I do ride at and then move them on. Those horses I enjoyed selling because I recognized that in them. the ones that I hate selling are the ones like our auditor is talking about. It's like, oh man, it's an awesome horse. But I feel like I'm not getting where, and that's tough. And Nigel's taught me a little bit about that, because I did not, when I got him, typical off track thoroughbred, oh, we're going to do hunter paces or fox hunt or do some eventing or one of those typical things. None of which Nigel has any interest in doing. So I had to take a real serious look, and I did this very, very early on when I got him. Do I want to keep this horse, or do I want to move him on to somebody else? And like we alluded to earlier, be straight with the people that I'm offering him to. He doesn't want to jump. He's not a good jumper. He doesn't fox hunt. He loses his marbles. Can't handle it. He doesn't want to do these things. But after a lot of soul searching, I decided to go the route of, well, let's just figure out what Nigel does want to do. Because I've been there, done that when it came to the whole eventing thing. And it was, you know, it's okay if I don't event anymore. Maybe I'll try something else, which is kind of what we did. That's a really tough place. And what I try to boil it down to is, do I have the skill to do this, the riding chops, or at least do I have the skill with a little bit of help? Do I have the money to do it? Because, sorry, working with horses costs money. And do I have the emotional energy? Do you get to the point where you just cannot bear to go out and work with this horse again? Those are the three things. And if I lose one of those three, then I have to just suck it up and that horse has to move on, because I have to have all three. I have to have the skill. If I don't have it myself, I have to be able to get someone who can help me do it. I have to have the money and have to have the emotional energy.
Yeah. And those are hard questions to ask. And sometimes, yeah, you do have to kind of take a look in the mirror and decide. And again, this is about your emotional well-being as much as your physical well-being. You know, if you're going out there just loathing it, like, oh God, I can't, you know, the horse training is frustration. It comes with a certain amount of frustration. That's all normal. But you know, when it's getting to the point of, do I even like this anymore? And when it gets to that point, you know, then yeah, why are you doing it? You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you're a failure or anything like that. It just means, hey, this is the match that's working out at this moment. And it is, you know, maybe it's time to look for something different. And that's where, you know, like the training horse that I sent home, he's kind of a roly-poly happy draft type and very different from the original horse that the person had. And they got very injured and, you know, were forced to look for something different. And, you know, we're all doing this to have fun and have that fulfillment in life and experience happiness. So when it's outweighing that, when the frustration and depression and, you know, you just not wanting to do it or you're afraid of doing it, when that starts to outweigh the good stuff, then yeah, it's probably time to look for a different option.
There we go. Ooh, we're tackling the big topics today. We are. So I'm going to take a quick break here, because we hardly ever get to play songs on Horses in the Morning anymore. And since I am in charge of buttons on Mary's show, we're going to play a song today. And when we come back, we're going to do another question from another auditor.
So far from winter, the grass is green. Hard to imagine that we will need to feed the horses so slick and round, but they're gonna need it when snow's on the ground. Hay in time, hay in time, making hay while the sun shines. Sweating bullets, I swear it's 99. Calling all your favorites, 'cause it's haying time. So call up your family, call all your friends, drink a cold one when the day ends. And when we stack that final bale, we'll celebrate and know we earned that ale. Hay in time, hay in time, making hay while the sun shines. Sweating bullets, I swear it's 99. Calling all your favors, 'cause it's haying time. If you are a farmer, you know it won't make you rich. It's hard work, that's no lie. But the satisfaction at the end of days like this, no amount of money can buy. Sweating bullets, I swear it's 99. Call up all the neighbors, the givers and the takers, calling all your favors, 'cause it's haying time.
And that was the wonderful Mary Ann Kennedy. You can find all of her music at maryannkennedy.com. And we're back. More questions from auditors. Who is our contributor this time?
We have one from Kayla, who would like to know fun things to do with weanlings and yearlings to set us up for success down the road as a team. That's a great question. And, you know, way to be proactive with the baby horses. So I would say most of your basic groundwork exercises you do with the horse, whether you're teaching them to lead or to back up or to move their shoulders or to move their hindquarters or to soften to the halter or to desensitize, most of those can be adapted to babies rather easily. What you need to keep in mind with your weanlings and even your yearlings is, their brains are baby brains, so they can only take in so much information at a time. And especially in the case of the weanlings, they don't have as much air as your adult horses. So you're not going to take a weanling and like lunge it for 30 minutes, obviously. So even if it's just handling them and practice tying them up and grooming, those are all things that you can start doing with them, or going in the pasture and just petting on them and getting them used to things like that. One of the exercises I like to do with my babies is to teach them to move away from steady pressure. So sometimes with the babies, because they are adorable, we get them really desensitized because we're loving to pet on them and hug them and smush their nose and all that kind of stuff. And then when there are giant horses and adult horses, they maybe don't move off of us so easily, and they kind of want to jump in our front pocket and be a little closer than we like. So in addition to petting on them and loving on them and all that stuff, I will do some pressure and release exercises. So what that could look like is maybe I'll stand at their shoulder and I'll take their fingertips of both my hands. So like, let's say I'm standing at the horse's left shoulder. I've got the lead rope in my hand to do this just so I have a little bit of control. And I'll take my fingertips at their jaw and at their shoulder, and I'm just going to lightly press into them, and I'm just waiting for them to get off of that pressure. So they might just lean away from it, or they might take a step away from it. And then as soon as they do that, I'm going to rub on them and let them know, hey, that was really good. And so not only is this going to help teach them, maybe if you're standing on my foot and I didn't ask, I have a button later on to get you off of me. But this is, yeah. That's important. But this is going to mimic some other things down the road for when I'm riding. So for instance, if I want to move my horse's shoulder under saddle, what I'm going to do, I'm going to press my leg into them and then hopefully they move away and then I release my legs. So you can start getting that concept through to them early on when they're just tiny little bitty babies. So that's how I'd move their shoulder, is I just kind of place both my hands into them. And first, you know, I'll just take my fingertips and just press into the fur, and then I'll press lightly into their skin. I'm not going to like really dig and pinch and like try to push. It doesn't take very much. And sometimes I might stand there for a little while till they kind of go, oh, you're pressing on me, and then step away. I want to keep it really slow and relaxed and easy. And again, by rubbing on them when they do step away, that's going to be my reward. Like, hey, you did exactly what I want. And then I might go stand a little closer to their hip and press their hip away. And that's going to be helpful. You know, later on when I'm tying them up and saddling them up, I might need to move them over. And so being able to just kind of lightly press my fingers into them and step them across is going to be really helpful. And again, I'm mimicking the kinds of cues that I'm going to use when I ride. Because when we ride, we're often using that kind of steady pressure, be it from the rein or our leg. And we're just giving them, we're planting the seeds for that to work out for us later down the road. Other places where you can work on this is I'll stand in front and maybe I just gently put my hand on their nose and ask them to back up. You could either put your hand on their nose or up at their chest and just lightly press and get them to back up. Picking up their feet would involve steady pressure, because I'm going to squeeze your fetlock until you pick up your foot. So if you can handle their feet a whole bunch when they're babies, your farrier is definitely going to thank you for it. I can take my hand and put it up behind their ears and teach them to lower their poll. So that's something you could play with all day long. You're not going to overtax your baby or tire them out. You can press your hand at the rib cage and teach them to side pass. So you can get all these buttons working for you before you even get on.
Absolutely. And all the things that we talked about earlier in the show, those are all life skills. They can learn how to walk on and off horse trailers without ever going anywhere, right? They can learn how to walk into a stall that's not theirs. For example, you have your young horse and taking it places in a horse trailer is really not available, but maybe you have stalls that aren't theirs. Because again, Nigel, my favorite pony, he really struggles with walking into a stall that's not his. It smells like somebody else. It's a terrifying place. Obviously, my horse didn't have these kinds of experiences when he was a baby. He must have lived at some kind of a place where he never got any exposure. One of the other things, I used to work at a breeding farm where we would bring the babies in and we'd prep them for sales and stuff. But definitely all the grooming things. It's easy to skip grooming with babies because, you know, you're not going to ride them. But all the grooming things, get them used to all the grooming things. Get them used to what a clipper sounds like, even if you're not clippering them.
Yeah.
Those are great.
You can start to do things. So one of the desensitizing exercises I do with my 2-year-olds that I'm getting ready to ride is that Jeffrey's method, or otherwise known as the human curry comb. And essentially we're climbing all over them bareback. Now, you don't want to climb on your weanling bareback because they're kind of small. You might be able to do it on a big yearling. But so even though I'm not ready to jump on them bareback, I can practice rubbing, like getting up real close to them and rubbing them all over with both my hands. And I can put my hand over their back and start to put a little bit of pressure, like, hey, I'm just going to lean on your back and make sure you can handle that. Maybe I'll get a saddle blanket. We could put a saddle blanket on your back. Maybe I could take a soft lead rope and just lightly wrap it around your tummy. And I'm not going to pull very tight, or I'm not going to attach anything, but I'll just wrap this lead rope around your stomach and your girth area and see how you like that. The other thing, and this is good for any age horse, I saw a program a trainer had out where he made it a habit with his horses to lead them kind of like on these little adventures all the way around his ranch or down the road, where you pretty much are like walking a mile a day with the horse. And it's something that was like a real epiphany for me, because I always think about riding. Sometimes a horse isn't ready for riding, or maybe I've got the courage to ride in the arena, but I'm too scared to ride outside my arena. So that doesn't mean you just don't ever expose your horse. You can lead them all over your ranch. So there's a lot of crazy obstacles on my ranch that are outside of my training area. So when I get a Mustang, for instance, and they're ready to start leading out, I'll lead them all over the place and lead them, you know, by the houses and around the trucks and, you know, through all the new and different things. If you have a road that's quiet and safe enough, you could take them down the road a little bit. And so you're kind of doing these like little mini trail rides with them before you actually have to saddle up and go on some big grand adventure. So getting them exposed to all the different things on your ranch is really good. And just lead them all over the dang place. And you're just allowing them to see the world so that when you do go out and do bigger and bigger things, it's not such a big leap for them.
Yep. Yep. And even a yearling, you can work with ground driving or long lining. You don't, because if you're doing it in a smaller enclosed area, you don't necessarily have to have a surcingle on them and you're putting it on their halter. So working with long lines, even if it's just one at a time, so that they can learn how to move away from you and turn away and towards you. So practice long lining skills. If you don't have any, practice on a regular horse first, not the baby. So I think of it as all the things that they're going to need to do as a 2 or 3 or 4 year old, those baby steps that get there. You always talk about how teaching, okay, my horse does not stand at the mounting block. Well, there's 15 skills that come before standing at the mounting block he needs to know first. So if you take any skill you want your adult horse to have and break it down to the sub skills he needs to have to get there, a lot of those sub skills are things that any horse of any age can start to understand. For example, standing still. Maybe you don't want to tie your foal or your weanling, but that doesn't mean he can't learn to stand on the end of a lead rope and be ignored. Just stand there with the lead rope in your hand with your arm folded and just stand there and exist and pretend you're a fence post. And he can learn to stand there and self-soothe. Okay, I'm bored, but I can look around and I can behave myself. It's amazing how many horses can't do that. If you've got a lead rope in your hand, they need to be doing something with it. Oh, why aren't we walking around? Why can't I play with you? Just something as simple as that. Because if they can't do that, they're probably not going to be able to stand tied either.
Yeah, and you could teach one that young a ground tie, and pretty much any groundwork exercise I can think of can be adapted for your babies. You're just going to take the intensity way, way down. You're going to take the amount of time. So, you know, young as a weanling, I would do like 10-minute sessions, maybe 20, and call it good. They're little sponges. They'll soak it up. They can only handle so much mentally, and you can kind of tell when they're starting to get done. So, you know, you don't want to take them to that point. You start getting them used to obstacles, lead them over poles, you know, teach them how to climb up on a pedestal. You know, if they can do a pedestal, then a trailer is going to be super easy.
Well, and every time they have success, you're only working for 10 minutes. So you make that, whatever your goal is for that day, you want to make it 10 minutes worth of goal. So my goal today is to get up on a pedestal. Well, no, let's break it down. I want my weanling to walk up to the pedestal and touch his nose on it. That's a good 10-minute exercise. But each time you make those small baby steps, you're reinforcing that new and different things are good. So you're not going to end up with an agoraphobic horse or a neophobic horse. Because a lot of horses, if it's outside their comfort zone, they, again, like we talked about earlier, they lose their marbles because they're neophobic. Anything that's new and different is terrifying because they developed a very limited skill set early on and they got really good at those things. And that's when everything stopped. So start down that road early on. You're going to have a horse as a 2 or 3 year old when it's time to start being ridden or driven and going to work. They're a lot less likely to have that. It's new and different, therefore it's scary. They're much more likely to have, oh, this is new and different. Can we try this together? And that's, after all, what we all want, right?
Yeah, you just want to build that, you know, you want to make those deposits in that bank account of just good, fun, positive experiences. So keep it short, keep it sweet, don't push them over the edge. And, you know, you're going to build their mental stamina to be able to do more intense things later on, just by kind of just, you make it casual, introduce it to them. We've got years before this has to be serious.
There we go. Dun, dun, dun. And we're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. And when we come back, we will have our final listener question of the day.
Easy, effective, and eco-friendly fly control starts with Fly Predators. Fly Predators are the organic, natural way to dramatically minimize your fly problem. Learn more about Fly Predators and other Spalding Labs fly control solutions at Spalding, Spalding-labs.com.
All righty, Mary, what's up next?
Yes. We have one from Rachel who says, how the bleep do I get Poppy to walk and poop with 3 question marks? So I can sense the frustration. She says she thinks it's physically impossible. She will sliding stop when the call of nature hits help. So I feel the pain. I recently went through this issue with my horse Remy, because I never made it a big deal when he wanted to stop and poop. I was like, well, I wouldn't want to have to run around and go to the bathroom. I want him to feel comfortable. And if he wants to stop, he can stop. And then it became an issue when we were showing and he would purposely hold it in until the middle of the class and then stop in the class and poop. He did it once in the middle of our cow work. So the cow's running away and Remy goes, hold up, and just poops in the class. And I am kicking on him and I can't get him to go. We got many penalty points in a trail class that we should have won because he stopped and pooped. So one thing I did with him in the moment just to get him to stop doing it, because like I said, I swear he was waiting until we were in the class. So what I started doing before the class was I'd take him out of the parking lot and I'd be like, get in the trailer. Because
they always poop when they get in the trailer.
Yeah. So I'd be like, get in the trailer. And then he'd poop and then we wouldn't have the problem. But obviously that's not the best solution. So I don't have an eloquent solution to this other than sometimes you got to get pretty big and say, you will walk and go. So, what I would likely do in this situation, I ride with split reins and when I feel them wanting to stop, I'm going to use my legs and then use the reins and say, you need to go now. If that is not working, you can at the very least turn their head to the side and say, move any foot. I don't care.
And I never would have thought of that, but you're right. Move any foot. Yes.
Yes. So, you know, sometimes taking their head to the side can help, and you can even help with your rein. I take my rein kind of over my leg and tap them in the butt and say, it's time to go now. And you can also do this on the ground as well. And this is something I never used to allow my horses to stop and poop. And I had a boss who would say, you know, oh, if a lion was chasing after him, do you think he would stop? No, he can run and poop at the same time. And then I got soft and I was like, no, you know, I don't want him to, he should be able to stop. And then it came in. So for showing, if I was never going to show a horse, I might not worry about it so much. But for showing it, it cost me some ribbons. So sometimes you have to get really big and crazy and just demand it and don't back down until you get some sort of movement. And it might take a while. It might take months.
Well, it's not like you can just say, okay, we're going to go. You never know when they're going to do it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. No matter what the outcome is, anytime they stop and poop, do not stop asking and make them move their feet. If I have to take their head to the side, I will. But we're going to learn to walk and poop at the same time.
Yeah. And I find it easier, excuse me, for a horse that has gone statue on you, I find it easier to get that horse to move a foot from the ground versus on his back.
Yes.
Because I no longer in my life am willing to go to the whip method, just not going there anymore. But when I'm on the ground, like in a round pen or on a lunge line or whatever, but I'm on the ground, I can just physically use my body language and they're going to move a hoof, because you can just jump up and down and act like a crazy person and they're going to move a hoof. So that might be an interesting place to start. Hand walk the horse and try to set yourself up for a circumstance where the horse is likely to want to stop and poop, and start there so that the minute the tail goes up, you use your body language to say, you will move a hoof, and set that up, and then go maybe to in the round pen or sitting on their back and somebody else walks beside the horse. And the rider, horse wants to stop and poop, you use your leg, but the person on the ground assists you using their body language, you will move a hoof. So maybe use that sidewalker. I thought of that because in Road to the Horse, the competitors are allowed to use, do they call it a pony horse? The competitor is allowed to get on
a horse.
Or saddle horse. Get on a horse and work with their student horse while aboard the big horse, because the big horse can help teach the little horse what to do. Well, you can do the same thing with the human being. You can put a human being that's the saddle human, the human sitting in the saddle, while the human on the ground is also influencing the horse. You do that all the time with little, with super green riders, right? The horse, the school horse isn't really listening to that rider. We know he's listening to the riding instructor. The riding instructor goes, okay, Susie, trot. All of a sudden the horse starts to trot, right? You might be able to use that to your advantage if you can consistently and effectively get the horse to move while they poop from the ground, but it doesn't work anymore from the saddle. Give yourself a ground person, or put somebody else on the horse and you be the ground person, and see if you can't make a little bridge between those two. And the horse goes, oh, I'm supposed to go even when you're riding me.
Yes.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Wow. Good question.
It's tricky when they've gotten in the habit. And I've learned, especially riding colts, I can get, and it's kind of hard to explain, but I can get like really big and energetic from the saddle without having to like wail on them. And it involves like, I look like a doofus. I kind of look like a barrel racer. You know how they do that kind of star
barrel racers
thing?
Send your hate mail to Mary at Horse Radio Network.com.
Not all barrel racers do this, but like you'll see some barrel racers where their legs come like four feet off the horse's side. And I'm, and I'm not like kicking the horse's guts out. I'm just like making this huge commotion. I learned to do that because when I'm riding colts for the first so many rides, I don't have spurs. I don't, you know, I'm not using a whip. I'm not. So if I need to like hustle their feet, I learned a way to get
make
like really energetic without actually having to pound on them.
I like
and
that.
So, yeah, I kind of, it's almost like the same energy I have when I'm working a cow and the cow's getting away and going the other way. I'm like, you have to go now, you know? And so it kind of takes a little bit of skill to work right. But the more goofy
and set aside your dignity, that's important.
Yeah.
Set your
I kind of want
aside.
The horse to go, my God, what is she doing up there? and when I kind of ride with that energy, like I just get like really fast and like, come on, we have to go right now. I find that I have to use way less actual pressure of digging my heels in or tapping them with the whip or things like that. So I would just, when your horse is starting to think about pooping, that's when I'm like, we have to go, we have to go, we have to go, we have to go. And you may not succeed the first several times that happens. They may still stop and go. But as soon as I can get that horses moving, I'm going to hustle their feet and say, we need to run it for the hills now. And then when they finally listen, then I'm going to release everything and reward them. And it's just going to take a lot of repetition and consistency. But you will get them over it, I promise.
There we go. And that's going to wrap it up. There, nothing can wrap up a Horses in the Morning episode like a talk about poop.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So for folks who want to attend one of your clinics, have you come to their place for a clinic? Buy some of your artwork, etc. Where can they find you online?
You can find me at Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship on Facebook. As far as artwork, we are at Troublemaker Trading Company, also on Facebook.
Dun, dun, dun. And you will be back again next month. We'll see you then.
All right, see ya.